we're talking about the rural-urban divide and setting the record straight. It's an hour-long conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. He moved his family 1,400 miles from a cramped home in the hectic, expensive gridlock of D.C. suburbs to the windswept prairie land of Minnesota, near a Starbucks 40 miles. His data set told him it was the absolute worst place to live in America. But data can't measure the human heart, right? Not turkey bowling, not walleye frying, not neighbors going out of their way to help neighbors. Some call it flyover country. Do you think we stereotype urban and rural life? How can we open our minds to different areas of life in Wisconsin or the greater Midwest? We're at 800-642-1234. Christopher Ingraham is a data reporter with the Washington Post. His new book is called If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now, Why We Traded the Commuting Life for a Little House on the Prairie. He's on the line from his home in Red Lake Falls, Minnesota. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's go back and talk about Oella, Maryland, this historic mill town. You're living in 952 square feet. And what is that commute like to D.C., to the Washington Post each day?
Yeah, it was awful. So we were living in, as you said, in a little tiny row house. We had just had twins, actually, so we were living in that kind of space with two-year-olds. And, you know, the weird thing about this historic village we lived in, the house, it was 952 square feet, but spread across four stories. So it was like all stairs. And if you've ever had tiny children, you know that stairs. So like this house was basically a death trap for the children, right? And on top of that, I was commuting, as you mentioned, down to D.C. So it's an hour and a half one way. So 3 hours a day, 15 hours a week. And I should say that's on a good week. The commute basically involved driving to the train station, taking the train down to D.C., taking the subway down to my work stop, and then walking a couple blocks. So there's four different connections there. And at any one point, something could go horribly wrong. A train could be late. I could get stuck in traffic, and which would either double or triple potentially my commute time. So I was spending just a huge amount of time. I calculated it out. I think it was basically over a month out of every year, like a month, you know, full day and night's worth of time every single year commuting. And we were just kind of being pulled to the breaking point.
You probably weren't seeing your twins during their waking hours either.
No, I would be out of the house before they woke up, and I would get back after they went to bed. So I would only see them on the weekends. And, you know, this is something that I think many families, particularly in these big metropolitan areas, wrestle with, where, you know, the jobs are in one place, but the affordable houses are in another. And over time, we see those places get farther and farther and farther apart. And at some point, something's got to give. And for us, we certainly reached that breaking point back in the fall of 2015.
Well, what is cost of living life? Like, what pushed you out to Oella, Maryland, to the, you know, outer rings of the suburban area of Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, we moved out there initially because my wife was working for Social Security, and their headquarters is still outside of Baltimore. So her job was in that area. But for me as well, it was also just that's where the affordable homes were. We couldn't afford anything closer to D.C., even anything closer inside Baltimore. And particularly once we, you know, and it was fine, the arrangement was fine before we had children. You know, you can rationalize those long hours on the train, but it's much harder to do that once the kids come along. And that was kind of the difficulty that we were facing.
What did it do to your health?
It was pretty awful. You know, so I joked back then that, you know, my commute was my exercise, because it really was. It was basically like adding another part-time job on top of my regular job. So essentially all of my free time was taken up commuting. So I had no time to exercise. I was drinking too much. My blood pressure was high. And, you know, these are all attributable in various ways to the commute and to other factors in my life. But you know, you can also look at just the research on commuting and what happens to individuals and also to societies where people spend a lot of their time commuting. It's not good. It really is just lost time, both for the people stuck in trains, stuck in their cars in traffic, as well as for their families and for their employers. Literally nothing good comes out of all this time that we're spending on the roads to and from work every single day.
We're talking with Christopher Ingraham. He's a data reporter with the Washington Post. He is the author of the new book, If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now. Do you have a commute longer than 30 minutes? What do you appreciate about it? Or are you trying to cut it down? How does that extra time on the road affect your time with your family? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You had a recent article in the Washington Post, and you discussed the average American commute time being at a record high. How much growth have we seen there in recent years? What does the data tell you?
Sure, yeah. And so the census had been tracking this for quite a long time, back to 1980. And in 2018, the most recent data, the average commute was about 27 minutes, just under a half an hour one way. And that's an increase of about 5 minutes one way since 1980. So back in 1980, it was about 21-something minutes. Now, 5 minutes one way doesn't sound like a lot, but consider that you have to do it twice a day, 5 days a week, you know, 50 weeks a year. When you add it up over the course of the year, since 1980, we have basically lost a full-time work week to our commutes. So 40 hours of commuting we've added to our schedule since 1980. So imagine how hectic your schedule is right now. Imagine adding another 40 hours of a time crunch to it. That's basically what we've done since 1980. And so where we're at now in 2018, the average worker spends about 225 hours or over 9 full calendar days in the car every single year. And I should say this is the average. There are many, many people who spend a lot more time than that. And it's a huge amount of time.
So going back to the living situation, did you consider perhaps selling your home and maybe getting a rental home or a rental apartment closer in to D.C.?
Yeah, we went through a whole bunch of different things to try to figure out. Even renting closer to D.C., it was, you know, getting well outside of our price range, at least for us having kids, where, you know, without kids, you can get away with a one-bedroom, two-bedroom. But when you've got, you know, twins, you need some space. And even closer to D.C., the rents were just getting out of control. It's not just the mortgages, it's the rents as well. So we looked at, you know, renting. We looked at, you know, finding, you know, buying another place. The problem was the only place that was remotely affordable for us was even farther out. So, you know, someplace in West Virginia, like the end of the train line, which would double my commute, wouldn't really solve any of the problems we were having. So we were stuck. And, you know, it's a lot of this is just a function of the crazy housing prices that we're seeing in a lot of these big cities. You know, San Francisco and New York kind of get the headlines there usually, but D.C., L.A., a lot of the big metro areas, we just really haven't figured out how to add housing at a rate that would make sense for the rate at which we're adding workers to those cities. You know, when we were in Baltimore, the average single-family home was something like $500,000 and up. And this is an hour and a half outside of D.C. And we were just like, what do people do out here that they can afford these? Is everybody an investment banker? Like, it didn't make sense to us. And so that's when we really started looking farther afield, started trying to think really outside of the box of, you know, different ways we could tackle this problem.
Well, we're going to explore outside the box, talking right now with author Chris Ingraham about the contrasts he sees between quality of life in the D.C. suburbs versus small town northwest Minnesota, where he is now. And you can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Chris Ingraham here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the rural-urban divide. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. numbers can't tell the whole story of life in a small Minnesota town. The biggest nearby city, Grand Forks, North Dakota, a 45-minute drive due west across the gorgeous Red River Valley. Washington Post data reporter Chris Ingraham was commuting 15 hours a week to get to his job, but that all changed when he wrote this disparaging story about Red River County. In his data crunching, it worked out to be the worst place to live in America. How happy are you with about where you live? Do you think where you live wears you down, physically or mentally? How does your commute affect your family time? Join in 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. And Chris Ingraham stays with us for the hour. Let's go to the phones now. Jim is joining us from Watertown. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I'll tell you. So I was born right outside of D.C. It's a little town called Clinton, right out by Andrews Air Force Base. And, you know, two-lane roads, it was a normal back then. Well, in the 80s, I ended up moving here to Wisconsin. Just went back to visit. I can't believe how populated, how crowded that whole area is. I'm driving right now on a two-lane road, and in Maryland, it would be a three at the least. As the increase of the people and the cars on the roads, the lights take longer. It drove me nuts driving around in D.C., and I don't know how I ever dealt with it when I was growing up. As a matter of fact, coming here, I couldn't even sleep for the first week because of the quiet.
Oh, wow. Jim, thank you so much for the call. Chris, Jim brings up the quiet, which is one thing that that really shook you too when you moved to Minnesota.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we were, when you live in a, kind of a big urban metropolitan, even suburban kind of area, you just get used to the constant sound of traffic. And that's what it is, like the background noise of life in the modern metropolitan area, it's traffic. And researchers have actually mapped this out across the country. And just the level of background noise in some places is really astounding. And, in some neighborhoods where people live and grow up and are trying to work and go to school, you have, traffic noise that's literally at a level that can be, that's bad for their health, that causes problems with concentrating at school and at work. And so when we got out to Minnesota, I remember we first took a drive kind of up through the state from Minneapolis and up to the northwest corner, and we drove through Itasca State Park, which is the source of the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of got out of the car just to stretch our legs a little bit, and when we turned the car off, it was, as Jim said, it was almost deafening, the silence. It was just kind of this all enveloping. It was almost a physical sensation. It wasn't just sound or the lack of sound. It was this presence. And we just kind of stood there awestruck for a while, and then we could slowly start hearing sounds, just the rustling of the underbrush or the sound of the wind through the trees. It was really a really intense experience for us, and it really drove home how much we were, the kind of stuff that we were sacrificing living in a big city and not even realizing it. When you're in a big city, you're not thinking about like the noise or the quiet or the darkness that you're missing out on. When you travel and spend some time in a place outside of the city, those things often come into full stark relief, and that was certainly the case for us.
Let's bring in Jen now in Eau Claire. Hi, Jen.
Hi, thank you. First time caller.
Sure, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to share, I'm relating completely with your guest. My husband and I just relocated to Eau Claire from the Milwaukee area. His drive was an hour plus in the morning and the evening, and we had just had a child, so same thing. He didn't see her. And now he drives 5 minutes. And it's a 15-minute bike ride, and just the life quality of life is just immeasurable.
I bet you've just found so many more hours in a day.
I'm sorry.
I bet you've just found so many more hours in a day.
Oh, ours, yes, and just sense of community. Not that it wasn't there, but we just didn't have time to find it.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for the call. Chris, you too found a sense of community when you moved to Red River County.
Yeah, yeah, it's actually, it's around
Red Lake.
Yeah. Where it is, mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is kind of funny. So this place we lived to, or we moved to, Red Lake County, there are no lakes in Red Lake County, actually. It's one of the few counties in Minnesota without a lake. The town we live in is called Red Lake Falls, and there are also no falls in Red Lake Falls.
Nope.
The place is kind of built on this bed of lies. But the community here is really something amazing, and that was one of those other things that we didn't even realize we were missing out on back in D.C. You know, it's kind of a stereotype of small towns that there's a greater sense of community. People come together, and you know, that's absolutely 100% been the case for us. And that was a big factor in our move here, because we wanted our kids to grow up in a place where they felt like they were part of a community, where you feel like your neighbors are watching out for you, as opposed to, say, Maryland or D.C., where we were really worried about our kids just kind of getting, you know, lost in the crowd, faces in the crowd. One thing I'll say is that after we moved here, one of our twins, Charlie, he was diagnosed with autism, and that was kind of the first moment for us. We were like, whoa, maybe, you know, maybe this move won't work. Like, maybe we need to be closer to a city where they have the kind of services that he might need. But we talked a lot with his doctors and everything, and basically the bottom line for the doctors was like, look, the best thing for him right now is to be in a small place in a regular classroom, but with, you know, people he's familiar with familiar faces every day, a place where he's not going to get lost in the crowd. And that's exactly what he has here. And you can just see it, too, with the kids in this area and just the way that they interact with Charlie and the way that they treat him. It just warms my heart, because, you know, he's a little bit of a different kid when it comes to the social things, and he has some troubles there. And I think back to my own childhood, and you might have had this experience too, where, you know, when I was in, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, we were just savage and cruel to kids who were different on any kind of level. But out here, the kids are just welcoming to him and to all of our kids, and they bring him into their games, and you can tell that, like, you know, Charlie knows all the kids in town, and they know him. I just think back to Halloween when the kids were trick-or-treating, and whenever they came by and they saw Charlie, they were just like, hey, Charlie, how you doing? And just a true warmth and sense of belonging, and that is something that we absolutely would not be able to get back in Maryland. You know, if he was in one of those big schools they have out there with, you know, 2,000 kids per grade or whatever, he would just be a face in the crowd. He could get lost, could get, you know, shunted off to the side and forgotten about. But out here, he belongs. And for somebody like him with the kind of, you know, the medical issues he has, that's going to be just an absolute game changer in the course of his life and in the things that he's able to do as he grows up.
We're talking with Chris Ingraham. He is a data reporter with the Washington Post, and his new book is If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now. Chris, let's look at 2015 when you write this article about Red Lake County, Minnesota, being the absolute worst place to live in America. What data set were you looking at?
Yeah, so this was summer of 2015, and, you know, Congress is out on vacation, and we're just kind of in the newsroom. We're kicking around ideas, you know, kind of goofball ideas that we wouldn't publish the rest of the year when there's actual news to report on. And one of the things I saw that summer was this data set from the USDA, of all places. It was called the Natural Amenities Index. And what it did is it ranked all 3,000-plus counties in the United States on natural beauty. And at first I was like, wait a minute, natural beauty, like, how do you quantify something like this? And what they did is they kind of took all these data points about physical characteristics. So they looked at average temperatures and how cold it got in the winters and how hot it got in the summer, and they looked at topography, hills and valleys, bodies of water, basically all the things about a place that make it that the average person would say, oh, this is a nice place to live. I think number one on the list ended up being Ventura County, California. So think they're right on the ocean, they've got that Mediterranean climate, they've got the hills and the mountains. And the place at the bottom of the list was this place I'd never heard of in my life, never even set foot in Minnesota prior to this, by the way, called Red Lake County, Minnesota. And it was in the Red River Valley, and it's flat, and the average January temperature is like -4. And, you know, there's, as I mentioned, there's no lakes in Red Lake County. So you kind of, you know, mash all these things together, and they end up at the bottom of the list. So I wrote this piece. I kind of mapped the data, and just because I figured it would be a cool thing. People love rankings. You probably know this. Everybody loves to see where their town or their county ranks on whatever quantity it is you're looking at. And I called out Red Lake County as, quote, the absolute worst place to live in America, which, based on this data set, it was. And I kind of just published it and figured that was it, you know, on to the next story. But Minnesota residents, as it turned out, really let me have it on it. I hit publish at 9:27 a.m., and by 9:32 a.m., the hate mail started rolling in from Minnesota folks.
Talking with Chris Ingraham, who moved his family from the Baltimore suburbs to Red Lake Falls 4 years ago. Now he has a book out about how he sees Midwest flyover country in a whole new light. You can join in, 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation with the Washington Post, Chris Ingraham, now a proud Minnesotan, right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this hour's conversation is about how a small, tidy Minnesota town got a bad rap in a government data set. Number crunching failed to measure the full heart of a caring community. Red Lake Falls has no lake, no falls, but Washington Post reporter Chris Ingraham is happy to call it home. He found residents highly invested in the community, and something he couldn't see from his stressful life 1,400 miles away in the D.C. area. Have you ever changed everything in your life with a big move? Was it what you expected? Share your experience, the outcome, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The book is called If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now, and Chris Ingraham stays with us. So, Chris, after writing about Minnesota in 2015, you decide to take a visit, try it out, see what it's like, because they basically told you to come. Is that right?
Yeah, so after I published the story, there was a bit of a firestorm, you know, we kind of had some fun with it at the Post. We published a follow-up story highlighting all the criticism. And eventually we got to a point, somebody from the community emailed me, and he's like, look, you should really come visit. And it was this guy named Jason Brumwell, who he said he owned a camping and tubing business in the county, in the town of Red Lake Falls. And the first thing I do is, like, I Google Jason to make sure he's not, like, a deranged axe murderer or anything like that. And then I kind of run the idea by my wife. I'm like, hey, you know, this community that I called out in that story, they actually want me to come out there. And she's like, they're going to kill you. Like, they're going to tar you and feather you and hang you up in the town square or whatever it is they do to people out there. Like, don't go. But I ended up going because my editors were very enthusiastic about this idea, ended up visiting. And I kind of had in my head an idea of what to expect. I grew up in upstate New York, and it's a place where the small towns are really struggling. It has a real Rust Belt kind of feel up there. And I was that's kind of the template I had in mind when I visited Minnesota. But I was surprised to find out that it was completely different, just a completely different mode of small town life up here in the Midwest in the Red River Valley. You know, the people I talked to, you know, I got the real sense that like any small town, Red Lake Falls, Red Lake County, they have their challenges. But this is a place where people were still really coming together to rise above those challenges. They weren't being overcome by them. And that was the big dividing line between Red Lake Falls and what I was familiar with from my own childhood. They were, you know, actively trying to make their community a better place to live. And you got the real sense that people would come together to try to solve problems, whether it was, you know, needing more money for the school or needing more resources for the community. They wanted to invest in that community. And that was a very big point of difference from my own childhood town, where people were so, you know, they were so concerned with just survival. It was such a challenge, just putting a roof over your head and food on the table, that you didn't have time to think about, to think more broadly to the community. So I ended up visiting it and actually just loving the place, which totally surprised me, totally kind of shocked my wife and my editors as well. And I came back and wrote this kind of glowing, you know, travelogue of my experience out here. And this all happened right along the same time, as we mentioned earlier, when we were grappling with all the questions of the commute, of high housing costs, of trying to find a home for our children. And so it all just kind of came to a head that year in the fall of 2015.
Well, so you're able to float this idea with your editors that you're able to move to Red Lake Falls. And, you know, you send this memo all the way up the chain at the Washington Post. You get the go-ahead. But this also means that your wife has to leave her job, which she's worked really hard and has a seat at the table at the Social Security Administration. What was the change like for her?
Yeah, it was definitely a bigger change for her. So for me, I just continued and still am doing my old job at the Post, data reporting. You know, 99% of that is done via phone and internet these days, and I can do that just as well out here as I could from D.C. Part of the appeal of moving to a small town with a very low cost of living is that one of us, and in this case it happened to be Bree, because she couldn't take her job with her, my wife Brianna, one of us would be able to stay home with the kids, and kind of, you know, they were two when we left, and so she was kind of able to spend those last years of their early childhood with them before they went off to school. And that's, you know, obviously for many reasons, that's a really great thing, that, you know, that time is so valuable and so important. But it was a challenge for her, going from kind of a high-powered government job to dealing with two toddlers all day. And, you know, she had some mixed, you know, feelings and mixed emotions. It was definitely, you know, she felt like this was the right thing to do right now. But it was, you know, she had, you know, gone through school, and she was the first one in her family to graduate four-year college. So she kind of felt like there was a sense in which she was just kind of throwing that away to be a stay-at-home mom, when even that's not exactly what happened. But, you know, she was grappling with those ideas and those questions that so many parents and mothers struggle with. And, you know, she's been able to make her peace with that. You know, she's managed to stay very busy since we've been out here. She's been volunteering with local arts councils and the city government. And that's one of the great things about being out here for her, is that in a community like this, they just need people to do so many things. And so she really likes being able to be involved and to do things to help the community in a way that she wasn't able to back in Maryland, where everything is just kind of professionalized and you have like a million people, different people to, you know, do all these basic functions. But in the small towns, they just need people to, in many ways, just to keep the lights on. And so she's been really happy to be able to help with that. She's actually on the city council of Red Lake Falls. She ran for city council last fall and got elected. So it's kind of funny to think that as a result of a throwaway line in a story I wrote, you know, 4 years ago, she is now making decisions that affect the future of this tiny Midwestern community in the middle of nowhere.
We're talking with Chris Ingraham, who's a data reporter with The Washington Post, and his new book is called If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now. Do you live in rural Wisconsin and commute to a city, or maybe it's the reverse? What's that trip like? Do you think people treat each other differently in rural communities opposed to big cities? Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chris, I was kind of surprised how difficult it was for you to find a home in rural Minnesota, to find a place to live. What was that experience like?
Yeah, well, you know, when we decided we were going to move out here, we weren't sure if we were going to rent a place or buy a place. And, you know, the first thing we kind of did is, you know, you go to, like, realtor.com and you start looking at home listings. And the challenge was there really weren't any, in part because it's such a small area. There are about 4,000 people in the county, so there just aren't that many places for sale at any given moment. But also because a lot of the, you know, the home buying and selling that goes on out here, it just happens as private sales between buyer and seller. seller, and you know, realtors aren't necessarily involved. So we did a trip out here, and some of the locals kind of, you know, they kind of beat the bushes around the county and rustled up information on who was looking to sell their homes, and we visited a bunch of places. One of the funny things, when we got out here for that trip, everyone was making this really big distinction between town and country, and they're like, do you want to live in the town of Red Lake Falls, or do you want to live out in the country? And we were kind of like, what are you talking about? It's all country out here, which compared to D.C., it was. But we went and looked at this one house, which is like, we drove, you go down to the end of the paved road, and then go onto the dirt road, and then you go to the end of the dirt road, and then onto whatever the less than dirt road is, and then at the end of that was this house, and it was way out in just the true middle of nowhere in the country. Beautiful little place, but when we were looking at the house, we noticed that there was a rifle by the door, and we asked the owners, we're like, what's that rifle for? And she was like, oh, that's for Brutus. And we're like, Brutus? Who's Brutus? And apparently it was this bear that would come around the house. And most of the time it was okay, but sometimes it would get a little frisky and they had to fire off a few rounds to scare it away from the house. And so we're like, oh, okay, that's country, right? Maybe we're not quite ready for that level of Minnesota living just yet. Let's kind of dial it back a bit and dip our toes in. So we moved to the town of Red Lake Falls, where we live in a little neighborhood, a regular little neighborhood.
Well, two Minnesota nice incidents happen, I think, at this moment that I flagged. One is that you don't bring your checkbook when you do find your house, and so your friend pays the earnest money, like writes a check for you, and then the realtor doesn't really care that there's a commission. It's just like, you know, give me a steak dinner. I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah. The process of buying a house, we ended up buying because there was no place for rent, really. Home buying in rural Minnesota, very different than it was in Maryland. So yeah, as you mentioned, you know, we've ended up finding this place that the owners were selling, and our friend Dick Brumwell, who was Jason's dad, he's like, oh, don't worry about the earnest money. I'll cut you a check. You guys can just pay me back. To find the house, we didn't actually commission a realtor as a regular process, but Dick had a friend who was a realtor, and he was like, oh yeah, I'll help you guys out, and no, I don't need the 6%, just buy me a dinner or whatever. And so those kind of, you know, you get a lot of these little moments of just human kindness and human warmth, and taken individually, they seem like kind of small little things. But when what we found living out here is when you add them all up day by day, week by week, they really add up to a fundamentally different experience of being with other people, of interacting with other people, and it makes just a huge difference in quality of life and in how you feel kind of wrapped up in a community and a part of that community. And it's hard to put words on, but I think folks who have had the experience of living in a small town and a big city would probably understand.
We're talking with author Chris Ingraham as his book explores how life in a small Minnesota town, very different than what his data set could convey back in 2015, when he called this place the worst place in America, Red Lake Falls. What do you want to say about your small town? Have you ever moved from a big city to a small town, or the reverse? What do you see as the pluses and drawbacks? How could small towns in Minnesota be strengthened? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us, Chris Ingraham here on the Ideas Network. Good morning. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about how a Washington Post reporter traded in a commuting life in the Baltimore suburbs, eking out a middle-class life. And when he set foot in Red Lake Falls, Minnesota, everything changed on the vast prairie lands. He found a community with immense heart and pride. How would you describe your rural community? Is it thriving? Still time for your story, your questions, 800-642-1234. Chris Ingraham is the author of If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now, and he stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Kurt is joining us from South Milwaukee. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call. in the early 50s, Bizarre's Erie was making the largest earth-moving equipment in the world. They sent school buses up to Red Lake County and Polk County, towns like Oakley, Fauston, Gonvick, many Thief River Falls area, right by Red Lake Falls, and they brought hundreds and hundreds of young males who didn't have jobs, came off the farms and came down here to South Milwaukee, Cudahy, Oak Creek area, and made their lives, and many generations have been here since.
Oh, that's a fascinating story, Kurt. Chris, what do you make of that, and where people do find jobs in your rural area?
Yeah, and so that's one of the challenges for sure for the younger generations is, you know, and that's, we hear that kind of narrative, and especially in the big cities, that's kind of the dominant narrative we have about rural areas, is that the young people move out to get a job and they never come back. But what, you know, demographers have been finding in recent decades is that, you know, you certainly see that people, they graduate high school, they go away to college, they spend their 20s in a big city, you know, meeting people and working on their job and honing their professional skills. What they're finding now is that more and more people who, once they hit in their 30s, they're married, they're settled down, they start having kids, they start looking like we did to get out of the cities and to get back to a place that's more similar to where they grew up. And so you see this actual migration out of the cities and to the rural areas in as people reach their 30s. And so one of the big challenges, you know, for rural areas and small towns now is trying to figure out how to capitalize that and trying to figure out how to welcome new people or maybe returning people coming back to their communities. But, you know, that's one of the challenges of reporting on rural areas from the cities, which is what all the big national news networks and papers do, is that it's really hard to get an understanding of those places when you know, in your typical story, like I was, you're either not visiting the place at all, or you're just kind of parachuting in there for a couple of days, talking to a few people, and then leaving. You know, I've found that since I've been able to spend some time here, some years now at this point, you know, my understanding of rural and small town areas is just, it's, you know, it's much richer than it was before I left D.C., and I think a lot of our particularly our political reporting could benefit from that, and I hope we see, you know, more reporters based, you know, all across the United States and not just in New York and D.C. where they typically are.
Kurt, thank you for that story. Let's go to Rick now, joining us from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning.
I need to concur with the with Red Lake Falls as a beautiful little community. I actually lived for a period of my professional years just north of there in Thief River Falls, and Red Lake Falls was one of my favorite little communities to go to, whether it was a spot to eat. They had a really good pizza place, a couple of cafes. I actually bought my pickup truck from the dealership there in Red Lake Falls. Just because the people there were even more friendly than the people that were in Thief River Falls. And it's, I think the author landed in a pretty unique spot for northwest Minnesota because there's actually some elevation changes in the town. If you go to Oakley or Thief River Falls or St. Hilaire, everything's pretty much as flat as a pancake. But Red Lake Falls has some elevation changes, and they've got the river going right through there and some cliffs, and it is a fantastic little community, and I very often long to be back there.
Oh, Rick, thank you so much for the story, and you can really tell from Rick there, lots of heart, Chris, where you're at.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he mentioned the elevation changes, and this is one of the funny things about the data set that brought us out here. When they measured water area, and Red Lake Falls doesn't have any lakes, but it does actually have two rivers that meet together in the town. They form these really kind of beautiful, picturesque bluffs. It looks like something you'd expect to find more in Montana or western North Dakota. But because of the way this data set was set up, you know, it didn't count that water area of the river. So Red Lake Falls basically got no credit for like the most scenic part of their community. And that was one of the reasons why the people there were so upset. They're like, what are you talking about? Like, Red Lake Falls is literally one of the most beautiful places in northwest Minnesota. And, yeah, certainly everything he said about the people there, we found it to be true. That car dealership, Siebert's, they're still here in town, and they still got the pizza place. And, you know, we've talked to a lot of people who have, you know, either lived here or traveled through here at some point in their lives, and they just all have really fond memories of the place, and that really kind of validates, you know, how our experience and everything that we've seen since coming here.
Let's bring in Dan now in Park Falls. Hi, Dan.
Hello. I'd like to relate a story about my brother-in-law. He and my sister were living out in California, and my brother-in-law was working for Lockheed. Had an hour and a half commute one way, and one day the kids came home from school and said they were mad because they didn't get recess. There'd been a gun battle on the playground. Well, this prompted my brother-in-law to seek a safer place to raise his family, and he was lucky enough to get a job at the university in La Crosse. So the first Saturday in the fall, there he is. He wants to go to a football game like he always did in California. And as per California habits, they left 2 hours early for the game. 10 minutes later, they were the only ones in the stadium and sat for over an hour and a half waiting for someone else to arrive.
Well, Dan, thank you for that story. Chris, I was chuckling, too, because I remember when you were relating your commutes that people in your neck of the woods may get stuck behind a tractor on the road and delay them like 5 minutes.
Yeah, you know, that was when I first visited out here, I traded kind of commuting more stories with the folks out here, and that's what they talked about. It's funny, living out here now, there are no traffic lights anywhere in the county. There's a couple stop signs. But now with my kids, when I'm driving around the kids and we, you know, drive someplace where there's traffic lights, we find they get really impatient. They're like, why are we stopping? We need to go. And so it's funny watching how they react to growing up in a place like this where you don't have those kind of traffic pressures. And, it adds a lot, man. Sitting in traffic, you survey people, you ask them what's the thing they hate most about life, and it's commuting. Like, people would literally rather scrub toilets than sit in the car in traffic. So it gives you some sense of just the toll it takes on people, I think.
How do you think your experience has separated the stereotypes that exist today between rural and urban areas, the rural and urban divide?
Yeah, I hope if this book does anything for people living in cities particularly, I hope it kind of demystifies the rural and small town experience. There's a lot of talk about the urban-rural divide and, you know, a lot of focus on, you know, when big city news outlets write about rural areas, they tend to do it in one of two veins. Either you have like the hillbilly elegy vein where like everybody is on meth and on drugs and in despair and everything like that, or you have this kind of bucolic splendor where it's a beautiful pastoral farmland and life is kind of, you know, similar to what it was back in antiquity. What I've found is that life out here, it's really just normal. It's regular, and I was expecting there to be a lot of differences between myself and my family and the people who lived out here. And in fact, we found just many similarities. I bought into the idea that rural people were kind of a breed apart and this totally different culture. I found that to be not true, and there's so much more in common that rural folks have in common with city folks. And I hope, if anything, it helps kind of foster that understanding.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Chris Ingraham is a data reporter with The Washington Post, and his new book is called If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now, Why We Traded the Commuting Life for a Little House on the Prairie. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.